the vault of startling monster horror tales of terror.
Hello, freaks, it's your old pal, the Chris Keeper. It's October, so this month we're celebrating. We're breaking format. There's not going to be talk about some stupid movie. Instead, we're going to read you scary stories. We're going to start with a little October tale read to you by me. I'd say I hope you enjoy it, but that wouldn't be honest.
The Open Window by Saki. My aunt will be down presently, Mr. Nuttall, said a very self-possessed young lady of 15. In the meantime, you must try and put up with me. Frampton Nuttall endeavored to say the correct something which should duly flatter the niece of the moment without unduly discounting the aunt that was to come. Privately, he doubted more than ever whether these formal visits on the succession of total strangers would do much towards helping the nerve cure which he was supposed to be undergoing. I know how it'll be, his sister had said when he was preparing to migrate to this rural retreat. You will bury yourself down there and not speak to a living soul, and your nerves will be worse than ever from moping. I shall just give you letters of introduction to all the people I know there. Some of them, as far as I can remember, were quite nice. Frampton wondered whether Mrs. Sappleton, the lady to whom he was presenting one of the letters of introduction, came into the nice division. Do you know many of the people around here? Asked the niece, when she had judged that they had had sufficient silent communion. Hardly a soul, said Frampton. My sister was staying here at the rectory, you know, some 4 years ago, and she gave me letters of introduction to some of the people here. He made the last statement in a tone of distinct regret.
Then you know practically nothing about my aunt? Pursued the self-possessed young lady.
Only her name and address, admitted the caller. He was wondering whether Mrs. Sappleton was in the married or widowed state. An undefinable something about the room seemed to suggest masculine habitation.
Her great tragedy happened just 3 years ago, said the child. That would be since your sister's time.
Her tragedy? Asked Frampton. Somehow in this restful country spot, tragedies seemed out of place.
You may wonder why we keep that window wide open on an October afternoon, said the niece, indicating a large French window that opened onto the lawn.
It is quite warm for this time of year, said Frampton, but has that window got anything to do with the tragedy?
Out through that window 3 years ago to a day, her husband and her two young brothers went off for their day's shooting. They never came back. In crossing the moor to their favorite snipe shooting ground, they were all three engulfed in a treacherous piece of bog. It'd been that dreadful wet summer, you know, and the places that were safe in other years gave way suddenly without warning. Their bodies were never recovered. That was the dreadful part of it.
Here the child's voice lost its self-possessed note and became falteringly human.
Poor aunt always thinks that they'll come back someday. They and that little brown spaniel that was lost with them. And walk in that window just as they used to. That's why the window's kept open every evening till it's quite dusk. Poor dear aunt. She's often told me how they went out. Her husband with his white waterproof coat over his arm and Ronnie, her youngest brother, singing, "Birdie, why do you bound?" as he always did to tease her because she said it got on her nerves. Do you know, sometimes on still, quiet evenings like this, I almost get a creepy feeling that they'll all walk in through that window. She broke off with a little shudder. It was a relief to Frampton when the aunt bustled into the room with a whirl of apologies for being late and making her appearance. I hope Vera's been amusing you, she said.
She's been very interesting, said Frampton.
I hope you don't mind the open window, said Mrs. Sappleton briskly. My husband and brothers will be home directly from shooting, and they always come in this way. They've been out for snipe in the marshes today, so they'll make a fine mess over my poor carpets. So like you menfolk, isn't it? She rattled on cheerfully about the shooting and the scarcity of birds and the prospect for duck in the winter. To Frampton, it was all purely horrible. He made a desperate but only partially successful effort to turn the talk on to a less ghastly topic. He was conscious that his hostess was giving him only a fragment of her attention, and her eyes were constantly straying past him to the open window and the lawn beyond.
It was certainly an unfortunate coincidence that he should have paid his visit on this tragic anniversary. The doctors agree in ordering me complete rest, an absence of mental excitement, an avoidance of anything in the nature of violent physical exercise, announced Frampton, who labored under the tolerably widespread delusion that total strangers and chance acquaintances are hungry for the least detail of one's ailments and infirmities, their cause and cure. On the matter of diet, they're not so much in agreement, he continued.
No, said Mrs. Sappleton, in a voice which only replaced a yawn at the last moment.
Then she suddenly brightened into alert attention, but not to what Frampton was saying.
Here they are at last, she cried. Just in time for tea, and don't they look as if they were muddy up to the eyes?
Frampton shivered slightly and turned towards the niece with a look intended to convey sympathetic comprehension. The child was staring out through the open window with a dazed horror in her eyes. In a chill shock of nameless fear, Frampton swung round in his seat and looked in the same direction. In the deepening twilight, three figures were walking across the lawn towards the window. They all carried guns under their arms, and one of them was additionally burdened with a white coat hung over his shoulders. A tired brown spaniel kept close at their heels. Noiselessly, they neared the house, and then a hoarse young voice chanted out of the dusk, I said, Birdie, why do you bound? Frampton grabbed wildly at his stick and hat. The hall door, the gravel drive, and the front gate were dimly noted stages in his headlong retreat. A cyclist coming along the road had to run into the hedge to avoid imminent collision.
Here we are, my dear, said the bearer of the white Macintosh coming in through the window. Fairly muddy, but most of it's dry.
Who is that who bolted out as we came up?
A most extraordinary man, a Mr. Nuttall, said Mrs. Sappleton.
Could only talk about his illnesses and dashed off without a word of goodbye or apology when you arrived. One would think he'd seen a ghost.
I expect it was a spaniel, said the niece calmly. He told me he had a horror of dogs. He was once hunted into a cemetery somewhere on the banks of the Ganges by a pack of pariah dogs, and had to spend the night in a newly dug grave with the creatures snarling and grinning and foaming just above him. Enough to make anyone lose their nerve.
Romance at short notice was her specialty.
Oh, hello. Oh, yes, I'm kind of busy. What am I doing here down at the mall after it's closed? Well, I have a little tradition. I like to go to the mall around Halloween time and burn all the Christmas decorations. Which reminds me, I've got a hot one for you. And I'm all fired up about this next one. It's a hot little number by the Hair Metal Hero, and let me tell you, this story has legs. Ha ha! 8 legs!
Spiders. The boy is 7 years old, normal, chipmunk-cheeked, cheerful and kind, and yet he detests with every fiber of his being all of those odious and repugnant 8-legged demons you and I call spiders. Why does he hate them so, you may ask? Well, if you or I knew why a well-adjusted 7-year-old boy hated spiders so much, we would understand a lot more about the nature of the universe, I suppose. The boy doesn't remember when he saw his first spider. He only knows that its presence set his hair on end, his eyes white and wide, and his blood as cold as a city street before the day's bustle. As a matter of fact, that same biological response occurs even still with the merest thought of a spider crawling in the recesses of his prepubescent brain. The boy really doesn't like spiders. The boy can't fathom their silence and swiftness, the inky blackness that clothes them in the day and makes them unseen predators in the night. It's not natural, he thinks, to have all those legs to run with, to make a rope that can be spun as to be unseen but felt. Oh God, how the boy hated the feel of a spider web. the constant stickiness of the thing, the complete and total attack on the decency of the daylight world, hiding in plain sight and ready to ensnare any poor little bugs or worse, a 7-year-old boy that had the very bad luck of being in the web place at the wrong time. To say nothing of the method of how those webs vacated the spider and ended up on his rosy little face. The boy really wanted to destroy those spider's webs. The boy was vigilant during the day, when the monsters were easier to see. But nighttime, right before bed, that was when the boy needed to be extra cautious. Every corner of his room was inspected, no, scoured several times just in case one of those bastards was waiting for him. Most nights went well. A few minutes of diligence and the boy would turn out his lights, wrap his blanket around himself, snuggle Bernard, who was his stuffed dog, his first and favorite toy, and then soundly fall asleep. But the times where a half-covered creeper in the floor, in his shelves, or on the ceiling was newly exposed and scuttled away from him and into a recess of his room that he couldn't probe, that was terrible. Worse than that, sometimes he would just plain lose track of where the little bugger went. When that happened, sleep was not something that could be afforded. Better to stay up all night and read under the sheets with a flashlight than be caught unawares. The boy longed to pinch all those little spider heads right off. The boy never knew when it would happen, but happen it did, and what seemed like more often than not. What do you ask would happen? Well, you know that sublimely wonderful feeling that embraces you right before your body succumbs to unconsciousness at bedtime? Of course you do. And so too, it seemed, did the spiders. That was always when one would stage its attack on the boy. 8 legs, perfect camouflage, not a sound. The best rope nature in her cruel wisdom saw fit to make. These are the tools of their terror. The assassins of the boy's usually ordinary life. Either crawling up a leg or hand or landing paratrooper style from the boy's ceiling, the boy never knew where they were until it was too late. They concealed their presence until the most evil time to strike. When is that, you say? Do I even need to tell you? Well, it's when they get to the one place absolutely no one wants something that's not invited. Right to the boy's face, over the lips and teeth, and into his mouth. Sudden jolting shock, always the shock. The fiends would invade him, sleep ruined, mind a shambles, panic sweats, flashes, the spitting, shaking, thrashing horror the boy would surely have equated to rape if he were but a few years older. The boy is going to kill all those spiders. The boy was ready. Never again would the spiders get him. He performed his due diligence and everything seemed okay. All the while, Bernard was vigilantly stuffed under the boy's arm. He had his Superman underoos on, cape and all, too. His implements were assembled, flashlight, check, candles, just in case, check, matches for the candles, check, candy bar and soda for the long watch ahead, check, baseball helmet on his head, fly swatter in hand, except this time, it was the spider's turn to receive the swatting. The boy waited patiently for his parents in the next room to fall asleep. When he was sure they were out cold, he took a long pull on his soda and a chunk of his candy. He flipped the flashlight on. The boy knew this was the night. The boy almost dozed off a few times, but he was determined. A little candy with a soda chaser, good to go. As the hours pressed on, nothing happened. Well, other than the flashlight pooping out on him. The boy fumbled to light a match for the candles he had placed next to his bed. His lithe little fingers were able somehow to strike a light in the blackness, and the dainty flame that followed the smell of sulfur was placed over one of the candles. As the candlelight flickered palely, the boy lit the other candles. When enough light had been awakened, the boy chanced to look down at the foot of his bed. The boy wasn't ready for what he saw. It was roughly the size of a softball. Well, the abdomen was, anyway. The head, big enough to notice the gnarled fangs and multiple eyes, even in the limited light. The legs were bent, unmoving at first. With the flickering, the boy couldn't make out the color of the creature. It was simply, to his eyes, a horrendous assemblage of living flame. The boy tensed. He dropped the matches, fumbled for the swatter. No dice. Even Bernard was useless at this point. The demon cocked its foul head, and the legs, in perfect silent formation, began to move. The boy's breathing came in asthmatic gasps. The spider inched forward. This was it. Now or never. The boy had to make his move while he was still able to muster some control. The beast's face was an inch from his. The boy bolted upright from his bed, the force of the ejection knocking the candles from their perch. In a perfect moment of horror, the spider, the boy, and the flame from the candles came together. The spider would surely have yelped if it had any way to vocalize, but the boy was silent, even as all around him was smoke and light and pain. Flames licked the room. The monster's hide cracked and blistered, and so too did the boy's. The morning brought still billowing smoke from the house, and tears from the boy's parents, who had escaped the blaze. And the boy? Well, he was right about the spiders never getting him again.
Ah, hello, friends. I'm just sitting down here in my rec room from hell, listening to a few records. But now that you're here, I'll break out a special one. A lot of people have been curious about the legendary story about the small town in Vermont that had the Halloween radio broadcast that drove everyone in the town mad. Well, your old pal the Chris Keeper is not above going into certain gray markets to find certain bootleg recordings. And so now, I'm going to play this rare record of the actual broadcast on that Halloween night. This is a rare record and can only be played on my custom record player, which plays at 66 and a 6. And now I present to you this rare recording by DJ El Jacone.
Pickman's Model by H.P. Lovecraft. You needn't think I'm crazy, Elliot. Plenty of others have queerer prejudices than this. Why don't you laugh at Oliver's grandfather, who won't ride in a motor? If I don't like that damned subway, it's my own business, and we got here more quickly anyhow in the taxi. We'd have had to walk up the hill from Park Street if we'd taken the car. I know I'm more nervous than I was when you last saw me last year, but you don't need to hold a clinic over it. There's plenty of reason, God knows. And I fancy I'm lucky to be sane at all. Why the third degree? You didn't used to be so inquisitive. Well, if you must hear it, I don't know why you shouldn't. Maybe you ought to, anyhow, for you kept writing me like a grieved parent when you heard I'd begun to cut the art club and keep away from Pickman. Now that he's disappeared, I go around to the club once in a while, but my nerves aren't what they were. No, I don't know what's become of Pickman, and I don't like to guess. You might have surmised I had some inside information when I dropped him, and that's why I don't want to think where he's gone. Let the police find what they can. It won't be much, judging from the fact that they don't know yet of the old North End place he hired under the name of Peters. I'm not sure that I could find it again myself. Not that I'd ever try, even in broad daylight. Yes, I do know, or I'm afraid I know, why he maintained it. I'm coming to that. And I think you'll understand before I'm through why I don't tell the police. They would ask me to guide them, but I couldn't go back there even if I knew the way. There was something there, and now I can't use the subway or, and you may as well have your laugh at this too, go down into cellars anymore. I should think you'd have known I didn't drop Pickman for the same silly reason that fussy old women like Dr. Reed or Joe Minot or Rosworth did. Morbid art doesn't shock me, and when a man has the genius Pickman had, I feel it an honor to know him, no matter what direction his work takes. Boston never had a greater painter than Richard Upton Pickman. I said it at first, and I'll say it still. I have never swenned an inch, either, when he showed that ghoul feeding. That, you remember, was when Minot cut him. You know, it takes profound art and profound insight into nature to turn out stuff like Pickman's. Any magazine cover hack can splash paint around wildly and call it a nightmare, or a witch's Sabbath, or a portrait of the devil. But only a great painter can make such a thing really scare or ring true. That's because only a real artist knows the actual anatomy of the terrible, or the physiology of fear. the exact sort of lines or proportions that connect up with latent instincts or hereditary memories of fright, and the proper color contrast and lighting effects to stir the dormant sense of strangeness. I don't have to tell you why a Fusilli really brings a shiver, while a cheap ghost story frontispiece merely makes us laugh. There's something those fellows catch, beyond life, that they're able to make us catch for a second. Doré had it, Cime had it, Angarola of Chicago has it, and Pikmin had it, as no man ever had it before, or, I hope to heaven, ever will again. Don't ask me what it is they see. You know, in ordinary art, there's all the difference in the world between the vital, breathing things drawn from nature or models, and the artificial truck that commercial small fry reel off in a bare studio by rule. Well, I should say that the really weird artist has a kind of vision which makes models, or summons up what amounts to actual scenes from the spectral world he lives in. Anyhow, he manages to turn out results that differ from the pretender's mince pie dreams in just about the same way that the life painter's results differ from the concoctions of a correspondence school cartoonist. If I had ever seen what Pikmin saw, but no! Here, let's have a drink before we get any deeper. God, I wouldn't be alive if I had ever seen that man, if he was a man, saw. You'll recall that Pikmin's forte was faces. I don't believe anybody since Goya could put so much of sheer hell into a set of features or a twist of expression. And before Goya, you'll have to go back to the medieval chaps who did the gargoyles and chimeras of Notre Dame and Mont-Saint-Michel. They believed all sorts of things. Maybe they saw all sorts of things, too, for the Middle Ages had some curious phases. I remember you're asking Pikmin yourself once, the year before you went away, whenever in thunder he got such ideas and visions. Wasn't that a nasty laugh he gave you? It was partly because of that laugh that Reed dropped him. Reed, you know, had just taken up comparative pathology and was full of pompous inside stuff about the biological or evolutionary significance of this or that mental or physical symptom. He said Pikmin repelled him more and more every day, and almost frightened him towards the last, that the fellow's features and expression were slowly developing in a way he didn't like, in a way that wasn't human. He had a lot of talk about diet and made Pikmin must be abnormal and eccentric to the last degree. I suppose you told Reed, if you and he had any correspondence over it, that he'd let Pikmin's paintings get on his nerves or harrow up his imagination. I know I told him that myself, then. But keep in mind that I didn't drop Pikmin for anything like this. On the contrary, my admiration for him kept growing, for that ghoul feeding was a tremendous achievement. As you know, the club wouldn't exhibit it, and the Museum of Fine Arts wouldn't accept it as a gift. And I can add that nobody would buy it, so Pikmin had it right in his house till he went. Now his father has it in Salem. You know, Pikmin comes from old Salem stock and had a witch ancestor hanged in 1692. I got into the habit of calling on Pikmin quite often, especially after I began making notes for a monograph on weird art. Probably it was his work which put the idea into my head, and anyhow, I found him a mine of data and suggestions when I came to develop it. He showed me all the paintings and drawings he had about, including some pen and ink sketches that would, I verily believe, have gotten him kicked out of the club if many of the members had seen them. Before long, I was pretty nearly a devotee, and would listen for hours like a schoolboy to art theories and philosophic speculations wild enough to qualify him for the Danvers Asylum. My hero worship, coupled with the fact that people generally were commencing to have less and less to do with him, made him get very confidential with me, and one evening he hinted that if I were fairly close-mouthed and none too squeamish, he might show me something rather unusual, something a bit stronger than anything he had in the house. "You know," he said, "there are things that won't do for Newbury Street, things that are out of place here, and that can't be conceived here anyhow. It's my business to catch the overtones of the soul, and you won't find those in a parvenu set of artificial streets on made land. Back Bay isn't Boston. It isn't anything yet, because it's had no time to pick up memories and attract local spirits. If there are any ghosts here, they're the tame ghosts of a salt marsh and a shallow cove, and I want human ghosts, the ghosts of beings highly organized enough to have looked on hell and known the meaning of what they saw. The place for an artist to live is in the North End. If any aesthete were sincere, he put up with the slums for the sake of the mass traditions. God, man, don't you realize that places like that weren't merely made, but actually grew? Generation after generation lived and felt and died there, and in days when people weren't afraid to live and feed and die. Don't you know there was a mill on Copp's Hill in 1632, and that half the present streets were laid up by 1650? I can show you houses that have stood 2 centuries and a half and more, houses that have witnessed what would make a modern house crumble into powder. What do moderns know of life and the force behind it? You can call the Salem witchcraft a delusion, but I'll wager my 4x great-grandmother could have told you things. They hanged her on Gallows Hill, with Cotton Mather looking sanctimoniously on. Mather, damn him, was afraid somebody might succeed in kicking free of this accursed cage of monotony. I wish someone had laid a spell on him, or sucked his blood in the night. I can show you a house he lived in, and I can show you another one he was afraid to enter, in spite of all his fine, bold talk. He knew things he didn't dare put into that stupid Magnalia or that puerile Wonders of the Invisible World. Look here, do you know the whole North End once had a set of tunnels that kept certain people in touch with others, which each other's houses, and that the burying ground and the sea? Let them prosecute and persecute above ground. Things went on every day they couldn't reach, and voices laughed at night that they could not place. Why, man, out of 10 surviving houses built before 1700 and not moved since, I'll wager that in 8 I can show you something queer in the cellar. It's hardly a month that you don't read of workmen finding bricked-up arches and wells leading nowhere in this or that old place as it comes down. You could see one near Henchman Street from the elevated last year. There were witches and what their spells summoned, pirates and what they brought in from the sea, smugglers, privateers, and I tell you, people knew how to live and how to enlarge the bounds of life in the old time. This wasn't the only world a bold and wise man could know. Ha! And to think of today in contrast, with such pale pink brains that even a club of supposed artists gets shudders and convulsions if a picture goes beyond the feelings of a Beacon Street tea table. The only saving grace of the present is that it's too damned stupid to question the past very closely. What do maps and records and guidebooks really tell of North End? Ha! At a guess, I'll guarantee to lead you to 30 or 40 alleys and networks of alleys north of Prince Street that aren't suspected by 10 living beings outside of the foreigners that swarm them. And what do these doggos know of their meaning? No, Thurber. These ancient places are dreaming gorgeously and overflowing with wonder and terror and escapes from the commonplace, and yet there's not a living soul to understand or profit by them. Or rather, there's only one living soul, for I haven't been digging around in the past for nothing. See here, you're interested in this sort of thing. What if I told you that I've got another studio up there where I can catch the night spirit of antique horror and paint things that I couldn't even think of in Newbury Street? Naturally, I don't tell those cursed old maids at the club, with Reed, damn him, whispering even as it's that I'm a sort of monster bound down the toboggan of reverse evolution. Yes, Thurber. I decided long ago that one must paint terror as well as beauty from life, so I did some exploring in places where I had reason to know terror lives. I've got a place that I don't believe 3 living Nordic men besides myself have ever seen. It isn't so very far from the elevated as distance goes, but it's centuries away as the soul goes. I took it because of the queer old brick well in the cellar, one of the sort I told you about. The shack's almost tumbling down so that nobody else would live there, and I'd hate to tell you how little I pay for it. The windows are boarded up, but I like that all the better, since I don't want daylight for what I do. I paint in the cellar, where the inspiration is thickest, but I've other rooms furnished on the ground floor. A Sicilian owns it, and I've hired it out under the name of Peters. Now, if you're game, I'll take you there tonight. I think you'd enjoy the pictures, for, as I said, I've let myself go a bit down there. It's no vast tour. I sometimes do it on foot, for I don't want to attract attention with a taxi in such a place. We can take the shuttle at South Station for Battery Street, and after that, the walk isn't much. Well, Elliot, there wasn't much for me to do after that harangue but to keep myself from running instead of walking for the first vacant cab we could sight. We changed to the elevated at South Street Station, and at about 12 o'clock had climbed down the steps of Battery Street and struck along the old waterfront past Constitution Wharf. I didn't keep track of the cross streets and can't tell you yet which it was we turned up, but I know it was in Greenough Lane. When we did turn, it was to climb through the deserted length of the oldest and dirtiest alley I ever saw in my life, with crumbling-looking gables, broken small-paned windows, and archaic chimneys that stood out half-disintegrated against the moonlit sky. I don't believe there were 3 houses in sight that hadn't been standing in Cotton Mather's time. Certainly I glimpsed at least 2 with an overhang, and once I saw a peaked roof line of the almost-forgotten pre-gamble type, though antiquarians tell us there are none left in Boston. From that alley, which had a dim light, we turned to the left into an equally silent and still narrower alley with no light at all, and in a minute we made what I think was an obtuse angled bend towards the right in the dark. Not long after this, Pickman produced a flashlight and revealed an antediluvian 10-paneled door that looked damnably worm-eaten. Unlocking it, he ushered me into a barren hallway with what was once splendid dark oak paneling. Simple, of course, but thrillingly suggestive of the times of Andros and Phipps and of the witchcraft. Then he took me through a door on the left, lighted an oil lamp, and told me to make myself at home. Now, Elliot, I'm what the man in the street would call fairly hard-boiled, but I'll confess that what I saw on the walls of that room gave me a bad turn. They were his pictures, you know, the ones he couldn't paint or even show in Newbury Street, and he was right when he said he had let himself go. Here, have another drink. I need one anyhow. There's no use in my trying to tell you what they were like, because the awful, the blasphemous horror, and the unbelievable loathsomeness and moral fitter came from a simple touch that's quite beyond the power of words to classify. There was none of the exotic technique you see in Sidney Sime, none of the trans-Saturnian landscapes and lunar fungi that Clark Ashton Smith uses to freeze to blood. The backgrounds are mostly old churchyards, deep woods, cliffs by the sea, brick tunnels, ancient paneled rooms, or simple vaults of masonry. Copp's Hill burying ground, which could not be many blocks from this house, was a favorite scene. The madness and monstrosity lay in the figures in the foreground, for Pickman's morbid art was preeminently one of demonic portraiture. These figures were seldom completely human, but often approach humanity in varying degree. Most of the bodies, while roughly bipedal, had a forward slumping and a vaguely canine cast. The texture of the majority was a kind of unpleasant rubberiness. Ugh, I can see them now. Their occupations, well, don't ask me to be too precise. They were usually feeding, I won't say on what. They were sometimes shown in groups in cemeteries or underground passages, and often appeared to be in battle over their prey, or rather, their treasure trove. And what damnable expressiveness Pickman sometimes gave the sightless faces of this charnel booty. Occasionally the things were shown leaping through open windows at night, or squatting on the chests of sleepers, worrying at their throats. One canvas showed a ring of them baying about a hanged witch on Gallows Hill, whose dead face held a close kinship to theirs. But don't get the idea that it was all this hideous business of theme and setting which struck me faint. I'm not a 3-year-old kid, and I'd seen much like this before. It was the faces, Elliot, those accursed faces, that leered and slavered out of the canvas with the very breath of life. By God, man, I veritably believe they were alive. That nauseous wizard had waked the fires of hell in Pigment, and his brush had made a nightmare-spawning wand. Give me that decanter, Elliot. There was one thing called the lesson. Heaven pity me that I ever saw it. Listen, can you fathom a squatting circle of nameless dog-like things in a churchyard, teaching a small child how to feed like themselves? The price of a changeling, I suppose. You know the old myth about how the weird people leave their spawn in cradles in exchange for the human babes they steal. Pickman was showing what happens to those stolen babes, how they grow up, and then I began to see a hideous relationship in the faces of the human and non-human figures. He was, in all his gradations of morbidity, between the frankly non-human and the degradedly human, establishing a sardonic linkage and evolution. The dog things were developed from mortals. And no sooner had I wondered what he made of their own young as left with mankind in the form of changelings, than my eye caught a picture embodying that very thought. It was that of an ancient Puritan interior, a heavily beamed room with lattice windows, a settle, and a clumsy 17th century furniture, with the family sitting about while the father read from the scriptures. Every face but one showed nobility and reverence, but that one reflected the mockery of the pit. It was that of a young man in years, but no doubt belonged to a supposed son of that pious father, but in essence it was the kin of the unclean things. It was their changeling, and in a spirit of supreme irony, Pickman had given the features a very perceptible resemblance to his own. By this time Pickman had lighted a lamp in an adjoining room and was politely holding open the door for me, asking me if I would care to see his modern studies. I hadn't been able to give him much of my opinions, I was too speechless with fright and loathing, but I think he fully understood and felt highly complimented. And now I want to assure you again, Elliot, that I'm no mollycoddle to scream at anything which shows a bit of departure from the usual. I'm middle-aged and decently sophisticated, and I guess you saw enough of me in France to know I'm not easily knocked out. Remember, too, that I just about recovered my wind and gotten used to those frightful pictures which turned colonial New England into a kind of annex of hell. In spite of all this, that next room forced a real scream out of me, and I had to clutch at the doorway to keep from keeling over. The other chamber had shown a pack of ghouls and witches overrunning the world of our forefathers, but this one brought the horror right into our daily life. God, how that man could paint. There was a study called subway accident in which a flock of the vile things were clambering up from some unknown catacomb through a crack in the floor of the Boston Street subway and attacking a crowd of people on the platform. Another showed a dance on Cops Hill among the tombs with the background of today. Then there were any number of cellar views, with monsters creeping in through holes and rifts in the masonry and grinning as they squatted behind barrels or furnaces and waited for their first victim to descend the stairs. One disgusting canvas seemed to depict a vast cross-section of Beacon Hill, with ant-like armies of the mephitic monsters squeezing themselves through burrows that honeycombed the ground. Dances in the modern cemeteries were freely pictured, and another conception somehow shocked me more than all the rest, a scene in an unknown vault, where scores of the beasts crowded about one who had a well-known Boston guidebook and was evidently reading aloud. All were pointing to a certain passage, and every face seemed so distorted with epileptic and reverberant laughter, I almost thought I heard the fiendish echoes. The title of the picture was, Holmes, Lowe, and Longfellow Lie Buried in Mount Auburn. As I gradually steadied myself and got readjusted to this second room of deviltry and morbidity, I began to analyze some of the points in my sickening loathing. In the first place, I said to myself, these things repel because of the utter inhumanity and callous crudity they showed in Pickman. The fellow must be a relentless enemy of all mankind to take such glee in the torture of brain and flesh and the degradation of the mortal tenement. In the second place, they terrified because of their greatness. The art was the art that convinced. When we saw the pictures, we saw the demons themselves and were afraid of them. And the queer part was that Pickman got none of his power from the use of selectiveness or bizarreness. Nothing was blurred, distorted, or conventionalized. Outlines were sharp and lifelike. The details were almost painfully defined. And the faces! It was not any mere artist's interpretation that he saw. It was pandemonium itself, crystal clear in stark objectivity. That was it, by heaven. The man was not a fantastiste or romanticist at all. He did not even try to give us the churning, prismatic ephemera of dreams, but coldly and sardonically reflected some stable, mechanistic, and well-adjusted horror. World which he saw fully, brilliantly, squarely, and unfalteringly. God knows what that world can have been, or where he ever glimpsed that blasphemous shapes that loped and trotted and crawled through it. Whatever the baffling source of his images, one thing was plain. Pickman was in every sense, in conception and execution, a thorough, painstaking, and almost scientific realist. My host was now leading the way down the cellar to his actual studio, and I braced myself for some hellish effort among the unfinished canvases. As we reached the bottom of the damp stairs, he fumed his flashlight to a corner of the large open space at hand, revealing the circular brick curb of what was evidently a great well in the earthen floor. We walked nearer, and I saw that it must have been 5 feet across, with walls a good foot thick and some 6 inches above the ground level. Solid work of the 17th century, or I was much mistaken. That, Pickman said, was the kind of thing he had been talking about, an aperture of the network of tunnels that used to undermine the hill. I noticed idly that it did not seem to be bricked up, and that a heavy disk of wood formed an apparent cover. Thinking of the things this well must have been connected with if Pickman's wild hints had not been mere rhetoric, I shivered slightly, then turned to follow him up a step and through a narrow door into a room of fair size, provided with a wooden floor and furnished as a studio, and acetylene gas outfit gave the light necessary for work. The unfinished pictures on easels or propped against the walls were as ghastly as the finished ones upstairs, and showed the painstaking methods of the artist. Scenes were blocked out with extreme care, and penciled guidelines told of the minute exactitude which Pickman used in getting the right perspective and proportion. The man was great, I say it even now, knowing as much as I do. A large camera on a table excited my notice, and Pickman told me that he used it in taking scenes for backgrounds, so that he might paint them from photographs in the studio instead of carting his outfit around town for this or that view. He thought a photograph quite as good as an actual scene or model for sustained work, and declared he employed them regularly. There was something very disturbing about the nauseous sketch and half-finished monstrosities that leered round from every side of the room, and when Pickman suddenly unveiled a huge canvas on the side away from the light, I could not for my life keep back a loud scream, the second I admitted that night. It echoed and echoed through the dim vaultings of that ancient and nitrous cellar, and I had to choke back a flood of reaction that threatened to burst out as hysterical laughter. Merciful creator, Elliot, but I don't know how much was real and how much was a feverish fancy. It doesn't seem to me that Earth can hold a dream like that. It was a colossal and nameless blasphemy, with glaring red eyes. It held in bony claws a thing that had been a man, gnawing at the head as a child nibbles at a stick of candy. Its position was a kind of crouch, as one looked, one felt that at any moment it might drop its present prey and seek a juicier morsel. But damn it all, it wasn't even the fiendish subject that made it such an immortal fountain. Head of all panic, not that, nor the dog face with its pointed ears, bloodshot eyes, flat nose, and drooling lips. It wasn't the scaly claws, nor the mold-caked body, nor the half-hooved feet. None of these, though any one of them might well have driven an excitable man to madness. It was the technique, Elliot. The cursed, the impious, the unnatural technique. As I am a living being, I never elsewhere saw the actual breath of life so fused into a canvas. The monster was there. It glared and gnawed and gnawed and glared, and I knew that only a suspension of nature's laws could ever let a man paint a thing like that without a model, without some glimpse of the netherworld which no mortal unsold to the fiend has ever had. Pinned with a thumbtack to the vacant part of the canvas was a piece of paper, now badly curled up. Probably, I thought, a photograph in which Pickman meant to paint a background as hideous as the nightmare was to enhance. I reached out to uncurl and look at it, when suddenly I saw Pickman start as if shot. He had been listening with a peculiar intensity ever since my shock scream had waked unaccustomed echoes in the dark cellar, and now he seemed struck with a fright which, though not comparable to my own, had in it more of the physical than of the spiritual. He drew a revolver and motioned me to silence, then stepped out of the main cellar and closed the door behind him. I think I was paralyzed for an instant. Imitating Pickman's listening, I fancied I heard a faint scurrying sound somewhere, and a series of squeals or beats in a direction I could not determine. I thought of huge rats and shuddered. Then there came a subdued sort of clatter, which somehow set me all in goose flesh. A furtive, groping kind of clatter, though I can't attempt to convey what I mean in words. It was like heavy wood falling on stone or brick. What did it make me think of? It came again and louder. It was a vibration as if the wood had fallen farther than it had fallen before. After that followed a sharp grating noise, and a shouted gibberish from Pickman, and the deafening discharge of all six chambers of a revolver fired spectacularly as a lion tamer might fire it in the air for effect. A muffled squeal or squawk, and a thud. Then more wood and brick grating. A pause. The opening of the door, at which I'll confess I started violently. Pickman reappeared with his smoking weapon, cursing the bloated rats that infest the ancient well. "The deuce knows what they eat, Thurber," he grinned, "for those archaic tunnels touch graveyard and witch den and seacoast. But whatever it is, they must have run short, for they were devilish anxious to get out. Your yelling stirred them up, I fancy. Better be cautious in these old places. Our rodent friends are the one drawback, though I sometimes think they're a positive asset by way of atmosphere and color." Well, Elliot, that was the end of the night's adventure. Pickman had promised to show me the place, and heaven knows he had done it. He led me out of that tangle of alleys in another direction, it seems. For when we sighted a lamppost, we were in a half-familiar street, with monotonous rows of mingled tenement blocks and old houses. Charter Street, it turned out to be, but I was too flustered to notice just where we hit it. We were too late for the elevated, and walked back downtown through Hanover Street. I remember that wall. We switched from Tremont up Beacon, and Pickman left me at the corner of Joy, where I turned off. I never spoke to him again. Why did I drop him? Don't be impatient. Wait till I ring for coffee. We've had enough of the other stuff, but I for one need something. No, it wasn't the paintings I saw in that place, though I'll swear they were enough to get him ostracized in 9/10 of the homes and clubs in Boston, and I guess you won't wonder now why I have to steer clear of subways and cellars. It was something I found in my coat the next morning. You know, the curled up paper tacked to the frightful canvas in the cellar, the thing I thought was a photograph of some scene he meant to use as a background for that monster. That last scare had come while I was reaching to uncurl it, and it seems I had vacantly crumpled it into my pocket. But here's the coffee. Take it black, Elliot, if you're wise. Yes, that paper was the reason I dropped Pickman. Richard Upton Pickman, the greatest artist I have ever known, and the foulest being that ever leaped the bounds of life into the pits of myth and madness. Elliot, old Reed was right. He wasn't strictly human. Either he was born in a strange shadow, or he'd found a way to unlock the forbidden gate. It's all the same now, for he's gone, back into the fabulous darkness he loved to haunt. Here, let's have the chandelier going. Don't ask me to explain or even conjecture about what I burned. Don't ask me either what lay behind that mole-like scrambling Pickman was so keen to pass off as rats. There are no secrets, you know, which might have come down from old Salem times, and Cotton Mather tells even stranger things. You know how damned lifelike Pickman's paintings were, how we all wondered where he got those faces? Well, that paper wasn't a photograph of any background after all. What it showed was simply the monstrous being he was painting on that awful canvas. It was the model he was using, and its background was merely the wall of the cellar studio in minute detail. By God, Elliot, it was a photograph from life.
Did you know? You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Twotruefreaks.libsyn.com is spelled twotruefreaks.libsyn, which is libsyn.com.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
You can find me, Scott Gardner, both on Twitter and Facebook. My name is spelled Scott Gardner.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
We are also members of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check it out at www.comicspodcasts.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up. Thanks for listening.
Join us every Monday for new episodes of Two True Freaks.
Two True Freaks has been brought to you today by Damanzo Core of Milan, Italy, and by the letters F and U.